We're big fans of Karyuma. They make cool, eco-friendly shoes that we basically wear 24/7. We're excited to be releasing our second collaboration with them, Karyuma, and Love It or Leave It. There's just something about the fall that makes you want to get new shoes, so why not get ones made with organic cotton canvas, natural rubber, cork, and recycled plastics? It doesn't hurt that they have tiny surfing dogs on them. They come in pink and black and feature a whimsical scene that'll absolutely put some pep in your step. Plus, Karyuma plants 2 trees in the Brazilian rainforest for every pair purchased. Run, don't walk, but not until you get a pair of shoes at cricut.com/store. Hey, this is DeRay, and welcome to Positive the People. It's me, Kaya, DR, and Miles talking about all the news that wasn't talked about as much as it should have been in the past week, especially with regard to race and justice. And I learned some new stuff today that I didn't know. So hope you will too. Then I sit down and talk to comedian and activist Amanda Seales to talk about her new independent documentary entitled In Amanda We Trust. And Amanda was amazing. So here we go. Let's jump into it.
Family, welcome to another episode of Pod Save the People. I am Diara Ballinger. You can find me on Instagram at Diara Ballinger.
I am Miles E. Johnson. You can find me on Instagram, Twitter, Threads, TikTok, at Feral Rapture.
I'm Kaya Henderson. You can find me at Henderson Kaya on Twitter.
And this is DeRay at DRAY on Twitter.
Well, friends, my news this week is coming out of the great state of North Carolina, where Republican legislators who hold a supermajority in the state legislature released 2 redistricting proposals this past week. Currently, the state's congressional delegation is split evenly, 7 Republicans and 7 Democrats, which actually reflects the political divide of North Carolina voters. Seems like that's the way it should be, right? However, under the new proposal, 3 House Democrats and maybe a 4th would be put in an almost impossible to win situation because of the way they are gerrymandering these maps. The North Carolina Democratic Party condemned the proposals, of course, and the chair of the party, Anderson Clayton, said, "Diluting our voices, specifically the voices of people of color, to entrench power is a manipulation of our democracy." And while you might think to yourself, well, a governor could just veto the maps, the Democratic governor, Roy Cooper, does not have veto power over redistricting legislation in North Carolina. So what would happen if these maps are accepted? The Republicans could win 11 of the 14 congressional districts in North Carolina. And, you know, we've been in lots of conversations. We had the conversation about the Alabama redistricting a few weeks ago, where the Supreme Court threw out their maps. They came back with another whack map and the court threw it out again. And here we are, friends in North Carolina who have not learned the lesson and are literally X-ing out, you know, mostly Black people's votes in North Carolina. The only thing that might mitigate this when it comes to the national election is Democrats in New York. Democrats in New York, pay attention. You could actually save us from this. The Dems in New York State have the power to do the redistricting maps in New York. And the way they draw their maps might cancel out any sort of national advantage that the Republicans have based on what's happening in North Carolina. Okay, so how did this happen? In 2022, the midterms provided wins for the North Carolina Republican Party that, first of all, gave them greater authority over the redistricting process, and it allowed them to flip the North Carolina Supreme Court. People think midterms don't matter. Midterms matter significantly because when they got control of the court, the new GOP majority in the court threw out a ruling by the previous Democratic-led court, which was a ruling against partisan gerrymandering. So the Democratic court said, you can't gerrymander. The midterms happen, Republicans win. The Republican court says, out with that, you can gerrymander. And that ruling created the maps that, the first ruling created the maps that reflect the state's currently evenly divided congressional delegation. But this new map will give Republicans 11 out of 14 seats in Congress, and that will tip the majority in even more in the Republicans' favor in this next presidential election. And so, or could, if New York doesn't do what it's supposed to do. And so I brought this to the podcast because I feel like there is a lot going on in the world. Of course, you know, Israel and Palestine, of course, and all the things that are happening right now. And under our noses, hardworking Republicans continue to encroach upon our democratic and ideals by disenfranchising voters. And if we don't pay attention, we wake up and realize that North Carolina, which was a pretty purple state, has now gone completely and totally red because of people's voting or not voting in midterm elections. So I brought this here because I think there are so many things, you know, racism seeks to distract. And there are so many other things that we are looking at that we're not focusing on things that are happening now. So to my friends in North Carolina, pay attention to what your GOP legislators are doing. To my friends in New York, pay attention to what your Democrats are doing with their redistricting maps, because we might need you to save the Republic.
I am just beyond exhausted with us having to save ourselves from our own government. It's like there's so many things going on in the world. There's so many things going on in this nation that are urgent. And then every now and again, aka every 24 hours, we have to make sure that the leak from the Titanic is not coming from the inside. Like we have to worry about the icebergs that are outside of us. And then also these just selfish, narcissistic, evil people who want to drill holes in the boat today. And it's inside the Titanic. And it's like, I think the exhaustion of it is like hitting me, the intellectual exhaustion of it. And I think that's probably the goal, right? To feel, for make people feel exhausted, make them feel like there's not, once you cover up one leaky hole, there's another one to cover up. And I love that you bring this to the podcast because it fills me up with some type of will to continue to fight. But Jesus, you all, like, it's always another thing. It's always another thing.
What this took me to, I don't know, I've been very much in a space of being connected to our ancestors. And so it took me to what was going on in North Carolina in terms of Black people and political engagement. So during Reconstruction, so from 1868 to 1900, there were 111. Come on, Kai, got on to Reconstruction. There were 111 Black men, albeit, in the North Carolina legislature. The latest I can find in terms of numbers as of February 2023 was 26 Black folks. Now, from 1900 to 1968, which were our Jim Crow years, zero Black folks. So for 68 years in North Carolina's history, there was not one Black person in that legislature. And so it brings us to today. And I think it's I've thought of what's happening today and what happened years ago, like definitely a through line, but I think in just like how I was seeing them, it was sort of disconnected. But I think stepping into the feet of our ancestors, it's like what happened between 1900 and 1968 can happen today in 2023. And it looks like that is what's happening. So, you know, I think that's the fascinating part to me, is that we're going to continue to be in this struggle, but like, how are we going to orient ourselves in this struggle, and how are we going to partner, work with our people so that we don't get back to zero Black folks in the North Carolina legislature and beyond? Because they're coming. They're coming
this
for us.
This reminds me. They're coming for us. DR, I didn't know any of those numbers about the Reconstruction era. Kaya, thank you for bringing this, because hadn't heard about it at all. And Miles, I think you're right. You're like, there are fights on every front, it feels like. What this reminded me of is that they cannot win without cheating.
Right.
That is
You better preach. Right. You better preach.
Come on. That,
There's a word.
We
There's
play
a word.
By the rules, they will lose. That's just the game. That's what's true. And the question for us in the organizing world becomes, how do we help people realize that they are cheating? Like, this is not, you know, they are cheating. This is, they are cheating, you know? But they can't win if you play by the rules. And as all of you know, the more people that vote, the more likely the Dems are going to win. Not even because people have some deep, what annoys me about this conversation is that people think that Black people or the left have some deep affiliation with the party. They don't. People hate the Democratic Party on the left. We just know that the alternative is literally trying to kill us. So, like, when people sit up and make a choice, they are like, do I get the people that I'm, like, shaky town about, or do I get the people who are like, you aren't people? And you're like, well, that's not a hard choice. That is actually a pretty easy choice. And when I think about this situation that you described to us in North Carolina, it is a reminder, again, that, like, they know that people will make that calculus when they have to. And they are rigging the game so that even when you choose, even when you vote, even when you do all the things, it is impossible for your vote to matter. And, you know, you know, we got to, I don't even want to say we got to play the game like them. We got to make the game fair. That's the goal. The game has to be fair.
Ooh, I needed that word this morning, honey.
That was,
Thank you, Brother DeRay.
So mine is about Brandon Johnson, the mayor of Chicago. And I just wanted to bring this here because there was this conversation happening online about his recent moves. And it made me think about what is our relationship to elected officials that we like? What is our relationship to elected officials that we work really hard to get in office? What is our relationship to elected officials that we identify with and that speak to our lives and our struggles? And somebody said it better than me, but this idea that you don't have to consider them your adversary, but they are definitely your opponent. And I think that is true. So when you think about Brandon Johnson, Brandon, when he campaigned, he said that he was going to get rid of ShotSpotter, which is a technology that purports to detect gunshots. And he didn't. So the first news that came out about ShotSpotter is when the contract got renewed in Chicago. Again, he said this as a declarative statement when he ran. Well, so all of a sudden the contract gets paid, and then his response is it essentially was on auto pay from the last administration, and the city of Chicago just automatically paid the new contract for ShotSpotter. And everybody was like, well, that feels really, you know, like auto pay feels like a weird way to justify that one, but okay, boom. And then he appoints this guy to like run public safety. This guy will not say he's against ShotSpotter. Mind you, Brandon ran. This is one of the claims that he made when he ran. He just approved the police union contract that gave essentially more money to the police than even Lori Lightfoot did. And he increased the police department budget. These are all essentially things that he said he was not going to do when he ran. Now, the question becomes, what do we do, again, when our friends, when people we like, people we identify run? And my reminder in this is that these people, even when we like them, have a job to do. And that we really do ourselves a disservice when we, like, if we, the way I think about it is, like, if we can't tell the truth to our friends, then we are really down bad. And if we can't hold our friends accountable, then we are we are down super bad. And I've seen people struggle to be critical of Brandon's decisions, Mayor Johnson's decisions, because he was a teacher and the teachers union and da-da-da-da-da-da-da. And it's like, buddy, you make some bad decisions, and we got to call him out. And that doesn't mean that the alternative guy was better. He was crazy. But Mayor Johnson, you got to step it up. But I think about this with Biden. I think about there are a host of people who, like, we like them. They do good things, and they make decisions that don't make sense, and we have to name them every time as well.
This is curious to me because if I remember the Chicago election between Johnson and Paul Vallis was the opponent. Vallis was heavy on the, like, more money for police, tough on crime, da-da-da-da. And Johnson, you know, positioned himself as the opposite of that, right? Of being reasonable. He spoke out against ShotSpotter. It's racist, it's blah, 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 and whatnot. And he gave more than $10 million more to ShotSpotter than the previous administration. Like his signature, it was not auto pay. The article that I read, I'll put it in the thing, says that his signature approved giving $10 million more to ShotSpotter. And so there's a question of, are you not paying attention to what's happening? Do you not believe what you used to believe? Like what is going, you know, I think there is also a question around sort of what union loyalties, you know, how they play into this, because as we know, labor, you know, often supports other labor organizations. And so it really is. I mean, I appreciate you, DeRay, sort of saying all our people might not be our people all the time, basically, is what you're saying. And I appreciate you providing some nuance and saying we're not saying, you know, anti-Brandon Johnson, but we are saying we have to call out, you know, fragaraga nonsense when we see fragaraga nonsense. And this is incoherent. This is misaligned. And mostly this is harmful to the Black community that Brandon Johnson, you know, represents, or at least claims to represent. So this is interesting. And this is going to make me pay more attention to the sort of policy decisions coming out of the Johnson administration in Chicago to see if he's walking the talk or if he perpetrated a fraud.
I'm just going back into the articles, just DeRay, about this, the ShotSpotter payment, because I think that's a curious thing for me too, where it's like we unwittingly signed something that the previous mayor, da-da-da-da-da, and I'm just like, in addition to being held accountable by activists, do y'all need some help with some interns or something in there? Just also,
yeah. You're hiring.
Right. It's like, can somebody check auto pay? Do we need to have DR on assignment to check the auto pay bills?
Listen, but
Chicago?
I do, you know, my compassion comes in because these are huge cities with huge bureaucracies. And it is sort of an impossible task to make sure that you are on top of every single thing at every single moment. But it's also democracy. So it is, if you do misstep, that's when folks are like, remember you said you was going to do X, Y, and Z? So I think it is a reflection of things working. And I think, Dre, when you bring up the Biden administration, you know, they are acting for the communities they hear from most. And I think that's most elected officials. And so I think we have to do an even greater job of ringing the alarm and being as vocal as possible, because if we had not been watching this, it would have gone on and no one would have known, been the wiser. So this one was really, really interesting. And now I'm more curious about Brandon Johnson. I hadn't really been paying attention to Brandon Johnson in Chicago at all, given that I live in New York with Mayor Adams. It's hard to pay attention to all these other mayors when we got what we got going on here. I am in Houston at the moment, and I can't wait to see the faces on this screen when I remind everyone that Sheila Jackson Lee is running for mayor of Houston. I'm going to leave that there.
Say what now?
And the party just endorsed her. Jeffries just came out and supported her. Mm-mm-mm.
Yeah. I think I have like a more general thing to say. And it's been cooking in my brain and it's still a little gooey. So if it's not coming out quite right, you know, blame it on my mind, not my heart. But I think we've expired the time of pretending that these officials are doing things perfectly is expired. I feel like there was like this weird time that when Trump left and even now, because everything's happening and Republicans are doing, you know, just evil villain type of stuff. I think that sometimes it impairs our ability to critique and it impairs our ability to hold these officials accountable. And what I'm seeing is this frustration with, we can't really say what we want to say about Biden or really can't really critique what we want to say about these officials because we're afraid that that's all we have. But at the end of the day, the whole system is not awe-inspiring. There's things that are wrong. There are things happening that are wrong. There's incompetence that needs to be called out. We can't be afraid of expecting excellence. And that's what sometimes it feels like, that we can't expect excellence because then we're going to end up with horrendous. And I just feel the frustration with that inside of me. And I know I'm feeling it. Other people are feeling it too. And we are going to 2024. It is going to be an election year. I am so excited and horrified. And I think that is going to be the thing, like just taking it to, I guess, the national like sector. Like Biden is not just going to be, you're not the red opponent, you know? And yeah, again, a gooey thought, and it's not necessarily cooked all the way, but I'm just feeling that frustration around having to be silenced or having to edit yourself just to make sure things keep going along and getting along. Thank y'all for riding that ride with me.
Hey, you're listening to Pod Save the People. Stay tuned, there's more to come.
So first of all, I want to just say that, yes, I am coming out on this podcast as, you know, beautiful. And beautiful topics are interesting to me. And when it comes to last week's body image and this week, anti-aging, because that's what beautiful people think about. And this conversation, I really wanted to bring to the podcast, A, because I love throwing things in all these brilliant people's minds to hear their opinions. But the reason why it was interesting to me is because it feels like there's a little bit of a guilt piece that's missing from the article. So let me tell you what the article is about. Days Magazine released this interview with this multimillionaire named Brian Johnson. Brian Johnson is described in the Days article as a vampire millionaire. That means he's doing all types of weird stuff with his son's blood to make him seem alive and all types of details about DNA, except in technology that basically makes your lifespan longer. The reason I'm always kind of reading articles about how just what's going on culturally and what people are doing, and the gaps are so wide that it's fascinating that all this stuff is happening. Some people are living science fiction novels while other people are like living these 16th century, you know, horrors, and we're on the same planet in the same timeline. That's always fascinating to me. But this was really interesting because A, there are other things to worry about. And then B, The piece around wanting to live forever feels like we're not necessarily getting to the fact that I really feel like these people are afraid to die, but not in the regular existential, am I agnostic, atheistic, do I believe in life after death? Not in that way, but in the way that they're afraid of consequence. They're afraid of less of there being oblivion in death, but more they're afraid of there actually being responsibility for what you did in death. Mm-hmm. And so sometimes I see these articles and I see this huge industry around that anxiety. And it's, and all of these practices that they're doing sound just as absurd as the evil that they're letting happen. The getting so much money and not thinking to share, and getting so much money and not thinking to, how am I going to let humanity happen? It's how do I live to 150 years and not live the last 50 years in bed? I'm going to read a little piece from the article that I found absolutely fascinating. And again, it's a kind of a long interview, so definitely go read it. It's on Dazed. Then there's Brian Johnson. You might know him as the multimillionaire who drained blood from his teenage son in a bid to extend his own life. Since launching his experimental blueprint project a couple of years ago, Johnson has evangelized for a holistic approach to anti-aging at every opportunity. His output, which showcases the expensive treatments he tests exclusively on himself, ranges from magazine interviews to glossy YouTube vlogs to dank memes. if we need help defining dink means, I got y'all. Then this is a quote from him. Blueprint was a contemplation of what it will mean to be human in the coming decades and centuries. Johnson says, looking back on projects not so humble beginnings, he points out that we spend a lot of time talking about how to build better technologies, computers, smartphones, virtual reality, or AI, and worrying about their risks. We spend disproportionately less time thinking about the future of us. That said, his vision for the future of humanity often means integrating with these emerging technologies. For example, he's developed a specialized algorithm to process all of the data he collects about himself, match it up with relevant science, and turn it into actual anti-aging treatments. In a nutshell, an algorithm runs me, he says. Initially, when people hear the idea, they think it sounds dystopian. The majority of my time is spent explaining the nuances. So, again, I think that what this does do is put me in the mind of some of these people. And of course, I don't want to make it seem like millionaires or billionaires are a race group, but I do think there's a commonality in how they're thinking. So it's putting me in the minds of what is causing anxiety in these groups of people and what they're concentrating on. And to me, this is connected to like the moon conversations, the submarine, the all these different things that they're doing to almost escape the reality. And I think in times like this, specifically with everything happening nationally and globally, I wonder what's the motivation to be here if you're not putting your money towards having clean air? What's the motivation for you to be here if you're not putting money towards it being a safe place that isn't overrun with terrorists and isn't overrun with crime? Like, what is your purpose to be here? I saw Fran Lebowitz in King's Theater a couple of days ago on Saturday, and she had this comment that really rang in my ear. She says, millionaires and billionaires often think that because they live in different worlds and they're in Aspen, that there's different air, but there's not different air. So everybody should be concerned about environmentalism. Everybody should be concerned about these other, these kind of global pursuits that the left is offering. And it's articles like this and stories like this that remind me that there is an intellectual logic gap that I don't know how to fill. Like, I don't know how somebody can look at the doomsday clock and hear environmentalists and then think, yeah, I want to put 150 years on my life, but the planet is telling you that y'all gotta go. We're getting eviction notices in the forms of natural disasters all the time. So
eviction notices. Tell it.
So I'm just super confused. So yeah, I don't have an assessment of it, but I wanted to bring that thought to you all. Like, what do you all think is that gap? I wanted to hear Auntie Kaya's creepy. You know, the creepier the better with Auntie Kaya. I love seeing her reaction to it. So I wanted to hear her thoughts about it, but also just kind of dig into what is happening that's making people be so narcissistic, to be so scared, to be so obsessed with their own individual life, but not think, but if there's not an earth for this life to be on, if the other people who I'm inhabiting this long life with hate me, well, like what in your mind is going to happen? Are you just going to like figure out the cure to life and then move to the moon? Like, is that the plan? Yeah. What's going on? Millionaire approximate friends.
You know what this makes me want to ask though? It's like, who are your people? Like, where you come from?
Well, Count Dracula, and that's what I'm apparently. Saying,
that no mention. I've been looked at all kinds of articles about this man. It doesn't talk about who his parents are, what values he got from his parents, who his community truly is beyond the Amazon man and the Tesla guy. I think, you know, and y'all know I'm just coming off my dad passing on September 29th. And one thing that has comforted me about my dad's passing is that my dad lived with purpose, okay? Every single day, purpose. And I think that's what's missing for these folks, Miles, is that their purpose is so self-centered and so inward that, yeah, they want to extend their lives because they're like, we ain't done nothing to help nobody while we here. So what is our karmic future in the afterlife? So I don't know. That's what this takes me to. I'm just like, they just seem like they are lost out here. So disconnected from whomever their ancestors are. So disconnected from who the community is and its extension of that Mother Earth. Like, I just, and all the pictures of this man online, I'm going to have nightmares. Listen. That's all I got to say.
Because we don't have television right now. Auntie Kaya has her thumb and her index finger on her chin, looking auntified and confused in a very butter pecan way.
So first of all, oh my gosh. So first of all, like, I read this and I'm like, say what now? So let me just read this one thing. Through various treatments involving lasers and light therapy, gene therapies, countless skincare products, a prohibitively precise diet plan, intense workouts, and a regimen of more than 100 pills per day, he's trying to rejuvenate his skin alongside the rest of his body. Yes, all of it, y'all, to the quality of an 18-year-old. He also colors his hair, though he's actively looking for alternatives to rejuvenate the pigment. Like, he's 46, he wants to be 18, and he feels like the future is going to be exciting, and so he wants to stick around to be here for it. I mean, the short answer is, child, bye. But you want to engage, and so I will engage. I'm an old lady at a group, right? I just turned 53, and I am embracing being an old lady. I'm embracing middle age. I'm embracing growing older gracefully. And like, as I look out at, I mean, it's interesting, Miles and Diara, that you sort of asked, who are his people? Who is his community? Who is he surrounded by? Because I do think that community matters a lot in terms of what mm-hmm. our outlook is about aging and the end of life. And like, I just think about like, how, I think about my grandmother who, you know, was 89 and lived one of the most joyful lives that I've ever known, especially as she got older. I think about, you know, I mean, I have lots of elderly men and women in my life who maybe became their most beautiful when they got old, right? And who were not spending all their time trying to hack life, right? Who were embracing life the way it was intended to be. I think about the Black community that surrounds me and how people are prioritizing, you know, farming. I think about my Indigenous friends who are bringing Indigenous earth practices back to the forefront. I'm thinking about how cooking is changing for us, right? And at a time where some set of people is trying to out-tech themselves into the future, I think many of us are going back to the practices that have withstood the test of time over centuries and generations. And so I do think that ultimately this boils down to, who are your people? Because my people tell me that growing mm-hmm. old is beautiful. My people tell me that there is wisdom in age. My people tell me that gray hair is beautiful. One of my best friends has a full head of gray hair. And honey, you can't go nowhere without men knocking themselves down to get at her. Like, and so I do just think that we fundamentally have different ideas about the end of life and aging based on who our people are. And this dude need to get him some new people.
I will also say that somebody needs to check this man's basements, because this is also giving me some get out stuff. And what is he not telling us? Because I'm sure he's looked at Black people and been like, what now? Why do you, Kaya, look like that at 53? So he might honestly go lock your door, Kaya, right now, please.
I also want to know who, what mother is letting her 18-year-old son give his blood to his daddy so that he could live forever. Mm-mm. But
this makes me think, not to be that guy who's like, capitalism is destroying everything, but Lord knows people don't eat excess wealth. You're like, you know, this is what happens when you just got all that money just sitting
and
around and time
and done
nothing
to
help nobody, and can't even, you're not even enjoying it out in the world. When I first read this, I was like, oh, he's 80.
He not even 80. This man 40-something. You're like, buddy. And also, there's another article that I didn't put in the chat, but there's another billionaire who, the guy who started Lululemon, actually, has a rare disease. And he is single-handedly funding the pharmaceutical industry to create medicine to attack the disease, because the pharmaceutical industry is like, not enough people get this for there to be medicine. And he is pouring his wealth into funding it. And it just is a reminder that like money is making a lot of decisions that, you know, other things should be making is one. The second is like, I didn't even think about like, where are your people as a response to this, but that is true. Like, you aren't even like enjoy, like part of the beauty of life is that it is finite, that you like know, you know it's coming, you know? And the question becomes, how do you make it matter in the in-between? And if capitalism is your goal and you have amassed as much money as can be gotten, I get how that would create an anxiety. Like that is, if that is your animating feature in the world, I get how when you reach that point, you're like, well, I just want to be here forever. Because you, there is no purpose. There is no meaning. Like that was the one thing and you did it. And that just isn't what a full life looks like.
Well, speaking of fascinating white men, my news today is about Hannah Crafts, who was an enslaved woman who wrote a novel that was years, I think in 2000, discovered by Henry Louis Gates. And then, maybe it was even prior to 2000. And then he then went out, Henry Louis Gates, and published this manuscript. But evidently in the literary community, there's always been pushback like, is this true? Could a enslaved woman really have written this? So part of this took me back to, remember when we talked about the portrait of Belazar? So the enslaved young boy that was in the portrait that was covered up, right? And part of that was like,
oh, yes.
You know, Black people in nice clothes didn't exist in the late 1800s. I mean, it blows my mind. Just like the thought around that Black folks wouldn't have a skill set or proclivity to, you know, write a beautiful novel. But anyway, so this New York Times article, which when I saw the headline, I was like, oh, fascinating. And I need to go buy Hannah Crafts, by Henry Louis Gates's, the published novel that he put out for Hannah Crafts, because I wasn't that familiar with her. I don't know what I was doing in 2002. I think I was in law school when I really wasn't reading any novels. But anyway, so the manuscript, the novel gets published. There's all this pushback around, can this be true? Is this truly resourced? Yada, yada, yada. So this guy, Greg, I'm going to butcher his last name, Hesimovich, Greg goes on this campaign to really prove, because we've got to prove that this Black woman has written this manuscript. So he's done all these years of research and now has put together kind of this biography of Hannah Crafts, who she was, but not only that, like who her descendants are. What you really don't get from this article is who Hannah Crafts is. But what you get from the article is how grateful we're supposed to be to Greg in his efforts to legitimize this Black woman. And when you Google Hannah Crafts now, guess whose photo pops up? It's Greg's. So I guess my struggle in this is, listen, the article to me, I'm like, you know what? You know, it's for the right audience, it's doing what it's supposed to be doing. Because like now I'm like, I got to figure out who Hannah Crafts is so that I can have my own experience with Hannah Crafts in a way that is not seen through the prism of this white man. Right. And, you know, clapping my hands that he went out and did this research, but it's still the way. And I remember this with the Belazar portrait. It's the way that the information is presented to us, right? It's like we're going to cover this story because this story has been legitimized by a white lens. And so therefore, it is good enough for us to bring it to you. And when you go into this article and you kind of click on the articles back to 2002, when Henry Louis Gates came out, put this, the bondswoman narrative out in the world, all the language around it is still slave woman this and slave woman that. So at least the New York Times has evolved so that now we're at least saying, because the headline of this actually just says America's first Black woman novelist. And to me, that is progress in that it's not, you know, first novel by a slave woman is found and da 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 da. So all that to say, I had lots of feels about this article. You all should read it. I am now going to spend my next couple weeks getting into Hannah Craft so I can figure out for myself who this woman is. And I'm sure I will have a deep appreciation and gratitude for her.
It will be a beautiful day when other people, specifically resourced white people, actually engage with the Black mind and imagination experience as a tool, you know, to know that like, oh, actually the work is not done until the Black person has engaged with it, until there's been other people doing it. And it's a tool. It's not just what looks good. It's not a vanity idea. It's also a tool that needs to be centered, because if not, these are the kind of storytelling things that happen. And this is the kind of erasure that that can take place. But besides that, thank you for bringing this person to I had no idea you educated me, Auntie Diarra.
I will say, Diarra, that's not exactly how I thought this conversation was going to go. I was, first of all, I had never heard of Hannah Crafts. I feel like I've heard of the Bondswoman's Narrative, which is the book that she wrote, but I hadn't read it, and now I'm really, really intrigued and am going to pick it up. But this story, I mean, one thing that I'll just say in my reading of the thing is it wasn't like Hesimovich set out to legitimize it. And in fact, he thought she couldn't have written a book, and he set out to prove that she was not the author of the book, right? Henry Louis Gates found a manuscript and he was like, oh yeah, this Black lady wrote this novel, I'm gonna publish it. And the people were like, nah, the Black lady couldn't have written this novel. And so they asked for the papers of her enslaver at Mr. Professor Hesimovich's university, and he jumped in and was gonna prove that she didn't write it. And his research then unearthed that, in fact, she did write it. And what was interesting to me about this is it tells a very different story. I mean, the book, I want to read the book because apparently it really tells a first person's account of slavery in ways that we don't usually get to hear. Much of it very, very gruesome, in ways that somebody describes, like, even reasonable people think is too much or something like that. But this Hannah Craft's master, or the family that owned her, apparently prized literacy amongst their slaves and taught their slaves their enslaved people how to read and write. And that is not a narrative that we usually get out of slavery times. We get that it was dangerous, that it was, you know, punishable by death to be able to learn to read and write. And somehow or another, this particular family thinks it enough of their enslaved people to actually educate them. In fact, one of the criticisms as to why it could not have been written by an enslaved person is because it actually pulled on themes from Victorian novels like Dickens. And in Mr. Hesimovich's research, he finds out that next door to the enslaver's home is some kind of a women's college or something, and they have Bleak House, the Dickens book, in the library. And so, and it seems like from her writing, she could have gotten access to the lessons from the students and the thing. And so For me, it's also interesting because it provides an alternative to the regular narrative about slavery that and literacy, right? And you know, I'm super interested in education. And I mean, this is a 304 or 305 page novel. Like, so this woman had time on her hands to write. She had resources to write. And, you know, he says at some point, I wonder why she didn't publish it. Well, I don't know a whole lot of publishers at that point who were publishing Black people anything. But I do feel like, you know, the historical universe, you know, gave us a little carrot and allows us to jump into this. It also, like, it just surfaced some new things for me. She lived, she went, she escaped, Hannah Craft
and she was in North Carolina, by the way. So this is like a really interesting through line through our early conversation.
Woocha. And she moves to Timbuktu, an all-Black settlement. And I didn't know about Timbuktu, so I got to do a little research on that. So I just found this chock full of interesting information that makes me want to learn more. And it just shows that Black women been killing the game since the beginning.
DR, never heard of her, this story, your read on this, top tier, 10 out of 10 notes. The only thing I'll add is I had no clue that this is only one of two known novels by enslaved or formerly enslaved Americans. One mm-hmm. of two is mm-hmm. wild. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's wild. Mm-hmm. So that's nuts. The second thing is Kaya. Everybody pointed out that, like, you know, as interesting as the book about Hannah might be, his intention was to discredit her. And we should never, ever lose sight of that. The third thing is that when I read the piece about Dickens, I'm like, well, maybe she taught Dickens. You know, like, the book came out, and that time, I'm like, maybe he's up here, like, striking similarities. I'm like, I'm sure he took all them riddles from Black people. I'm sure the storytelling with some stuff that the Black woman who raised him told stories in a way, and he wrote it down. That was my assumption from jump. It was not that she borrowed. It was that he borrowed, and he got... And by borrowed, I mean stole. He stole a storytelling technique. And what makes me annoyed by this is that I was watching a very cute video, actually, of this country star the other day on TikTok. And I was reminded that Black people made that, too. You know, I'm like, all this stuff is Black people's who made the American project a project. And I was like, annoyed in my bones.
Don't go anywhere. More Pod Save the People's coming.
This week, we welcome comedian, activist, and creative visionary Amanda Seales on the pod to talk about her new political comedy documentary, In Amanda We Trust. The doc follows Amanda in Washington, D.C. on a journey of curiosity to find out if she could or should run for political office. We also got a chance to discuss a host of other things. Amanda is amazing, and it was such a good conversation. I learned some stuff about her. I hope we can do some cool things together because she's dope. And she knows a lot about Black history, about the world, about America, has lots about politics. You'll love her. I do. Here we go. The one and only Amanda Seales. Thank you so much for joining us today on Pod Save the People.
Thank you for having me.
Well, I love the documentary. I have a lot of questions about some parts of it. But before we start there, can you tell us, like, your journey, not only to comedy, but to using your voice to talk about these societal issues, which is not what a lot of your peers are doing, and you have done it consistently, whether it is the documentary, whether it's Instagram. I actually just met somebody the other day, and he said to me, he was like, do you know she has the show that's live? Da-da-da-da. He's like, Amanda Seales, do you know her? And I was like, I'll be talking to her soon. So talk to me about that process.
That's always been who I am. It wasn't even a process. Like, honestly, like, that's always been just the way that I kind of processed my art. I grew up in a Grenadian household where literally today, as we're recording, this is the I don't like the word anniversary for these types of things, but this was the day that Maurice Bishop was put in front of a firing squad and murdered in Grenada, who was a revolutionary in Grenada. Whether you agree with what he was doing or not, he was a revolutionary. So like, I come from a revolutionary people is my point. And I grew up, you know, just listening to a lot of Bob Marley. And I just feel like, you know, you hear Redemption Song enough times, you hear Buffalo Soldier enough times, you hear Get Up, Stand Up enough times, like it becomes a part of your molecular DNA. And so I've just always been somebody who was consciously aware of just injustice. Like I remember when I was like in preschool, when I was three, the teacher told us we were stupid. And I came home and told my mom, like, this is an outrage. This lady told us we were stupid, you know? And my mom like came up in that school and was like, don't you ever call these children stupid again, you know? So like,
Come on, mom.
So like, that's always been my MO. And as I gained more knowledge and more confidence, right, and more support in my life, it just became a lot less of a thing that I just naturally did and like a thing that I felt like purposeful in doing. And I purposely went to Columbia. I went to grad school for African American studies with the very clear intention that I'm coming here because I want to speak for and on behalf of and in, you know, in the empowering of my people. And I feel like I need to have like this academic background to go along with what I have because I know this country and what it's on. And so that's always been it, you know, to be honest, DeRay, like, I don't think I, like, of course there's been projects that I've been a part of that like weren't necessarily about that, you know, like, I don't feel like Insecure was like, I mean, Insecure by its nature was definitely like a game changer, but like, it wasn't like we was on there talking about Palestine.
Right. You know, next year will be the 10 years since Ferguson. And it has made me really think about how much we all have learned and grown since the August of 2014. I'm interested in what has that been like for you? You know, you think about your grad school experience and learning in the classroom, and just it feels like the conversation has just shifted so much in 10 years in some ways. And then some ways I'm like, whew, we are still stuck. But what has your journey looked like in terms of what you've learned? I even think about the first time I got challenged for using crazy. I used to be like, that's so crazy. And people like, DeRay, you can't keep calling things crazy like that. And I was like, right. Oh, I didn't even, you know, so like ableist language I didn't know about. I think about like the conversation about trans. I've learned so much in ways that I didn't even know I didn't know. So I'd love to know what that has been like for you.
Sometimes I'm with it. Sometimes I'm like, come on, y'all.
Amanda.
Like, come on, y'all. Just because like I am a comedian, right? So there is something to be said for like, everything doesn't have to be everything. Like everything doesn't have to be couched in like, when we talk about like the PC of it all, when people first started saying that, I was like, I don't understand like how that's difficult for y'all. Because I took it more so like, well, I'm not out here being transphobic in my comedy and I'm not out here being racist or misogynist in my comedy. So like, why would that be difficult for y'all? But then it got into, you know, just like specific words. Like you can't say lame because that means da da da. Like you can't say someone is tone deaf because that, et cetera, et cetera. And so I think there's something to be said though for this, like, there's like a literalness that I don't think necessarily serves us in the best way all the time. I think that there's ways in which language can be used that have multiple meanings. And I think that there's some things that we find out like are derived from very disingenuous, very like negative places. And then there are some things that are simply just descriptive. For instance, like I learned recently that like the term tone deaf, people were like, that's ableist.
Yeah.
I think though there's something to be said for the fact that like, to my understanding, the term tone deaf did not come from being derogatory to individuals who are hard of hearing. It came from combining one word that means one thing and one word that means one thing and bringing them together to mean a new thing. Yes. And so I think there's a difference. And I think that sometimes when we don't acknowledge that difference, we get caught up in things that aren't necessarily bringing us forward. I mean, of course, somebody who's deaf might be like, well, you know, fuck you, Amanda. How dare you? Right? Like that is bringing us backwards. But you asked me, so I'm answering.
I appreciate the push. Okay, let's talk about the documentary. I feel like I'm pretty aware and I know people's stories. And then I watched your conversation with Bowman and I was like, didn't know this part of his story. I like just straight up didn't. I knew he was a teacher. I didn't know the part about
the students,
the kids who were self-harming. Like, didn't know it. I like listened and I was like, oh, okay. Like, Amanda, teach me. Can you talk about what led you to do the documentary? You've obviously done it and you've been telling the truth and telling stories in a host of formats already. Why the documentary?
I got to tell you, I was led. Most things, it's like Amanda's on a mission. I'm going to do this thing. And then I do it. It wasn't that way with this. You know, I really set out, DeRay, to do... I really set out to do a stand-up special. That was the plan. I was going to do a stand-up special. And when that didn't end up happening because I realized like I didn't have the money to like do the special at the level I wanted to do it, I said, okay, I'm going to take a different route and I'll just use old footage, but then I'll do like some segments that I can put in between the old footage that will like spruce it up. And when we went to shoot the segments, we just got such an abundance of dope footage that we were like, huh. And I kept saying, man, we got such good footage, man. We may not even need to stand up. You know what I'm saying? And I, you know, careful what you say, right? Because then we hit a wall where we realized that the previous footage that we had was not the same quality in terms of like the technical aspect of it. And it would have looked like two different films, like, and not in like the, not in a good way, not in like an artsy way. You know what I mean?
Right.
And so then I had to just make a decision. And I spoke to my director. This is also the beauty of doing something independent. Like I had to make a decision, you know what I'm saying?
Yes.
Like I didn't have to think about it and then think about now, how am I going to ask Massa for, you know,
Amanda
permission. So I was really proud of us because we made like a quick decision. And thankfully we had an editor, shout out to Mark, who was just like, all right, let's do it. And we turned and we pivoted. And here came this documentary, which it's so funny how often things just happen by accident, right? Like I've never seen a format like this before, which is why it became even difficult on like what to call it. And then eventually we're like, well, it is a doc. I mean, you're just taking a different route, but it is a doc. And what also led me here, just in terms of the segments and deciding to even do these segments before they were compiled in a documentary, was the reality that so many people are complaining or frustrated about the state of things, but really don't know how it got here or how to change it. And I think considering what we're watching unfold this week with the genocide in Palestine and the way the American government is responding to it, it heightens even more the necessity to really understand what role do politicians and politicians as lawmakers, what role do they play in our lives? Because I really feel like we've gotten way too far away. And the further we get away from government, the more it becomes involved in our lives.
I will say there's that part at the towards the end where you're doing the like person on the street interviews and one person's like, healthcare for all. Another person's like,
free movies.
Right, free movies. I was like, whoo, Amanda, this is honest. I was like, because she said healthcare for all so confident. I'm like, oh, what she got? And then she was like, you know what? I love part. And then she pivoted to what, libraries or something? I was like, girl, parties is what you actually.
Right. Pizza parties.
I was like, oh, goodness. Now, I'm happy you said that, though, in terms of especially the current crisis that's happening around watching genocide in real time. What has it been? What have you learned, or what has it been like to teach people? Like, what have you learned about the way people do think about the government? Or like, is there a question that people have that you're like, oh, I didn't think this is what we were going to have to spend a lot of time on, but this is the thing? Or are people too busy to? What's the help?
The
me.
Number one
help
thing. Us. The number one thing that I've noticed is that people, and I want to also say, like, none of this is coming from an elitist place. I am learning as I'm teaching. Like, I am somebody who had disassociated myself from politics because I was so done with Trump. And then, you know, realized like, yeah, you don't get to do that. Especially as a Black person in America, you simply just don't get to do that. Like if you, the more you disassociate, trust me, you associated. And so I've had to immerse myself and learn. And, you know, I think the thing that was very revelatory for me that seemed oddly obvious, but that I was missing and that I think a lot of us are missing is that these are not simply politicians. These are law makers. Like when we think politician at this point, I think a lot of us just think people who act like Hollywood in DC.
Interesting.
Like that's really, I mean, we had a reality star as a president. Like that to me is where I think a lot of people look at it. They look at it, and even if it's not in DC or it's local, it's almost as if people look at they look at it like just like a job description versus there being an actual action behind it that directly affects you. And I know that we've said this, but I think that the fact that we refer to people as politicians disconnects folks from the actual reality that they are signing into law things that change your life. They are the ones with the stroke of the pen that can change it. And when we don't have that connectivity, we become less accountable for ourselves in how we affect who gets that power. Right. We're not even thinking in that way, you know, and it's something that I'm like challenging myself, like stop calling these people politicians, call them lawmakers, call them lawmakers, call them lawmakers, because like literally your language needs to change in how you refer to these people to help people like get grounded. We are very unknowledgeable as a people in America by nature of just the lack of curriculum around previous and current discriminations and oppressive law, legislation, et cetera. Like we don't realize how much we don't know. So like, I feel like I am in a constant state of awakening about how this operation runs. And at the bottom line, I think most of us are really not truly connected to the realities of they made these laws and they can take these laws. They made these laws. They can change these laws and they can take these laws. Like the poly and politician is really policy.
Is that a t-shirt? You need to make that a t-shirt. You need to make that a, I am ordering the first t-shirt. Put that on a sweatshirt. I'm in. One of the things that I've been interested in too, in that vein is, you know, I'm obviously an organizer day to day and we say everything goes back to race because it really does go back. Like it's not like everything. A conspiracy theory. You're like, but I've been shocked where people are like, you're being dramatic. And I'm like, I don't know. I think the world was dramatic. You know, I'm like, I think that the truth is actually wild. And I was having this conversation with somebody the other day about like, we gave white people homes, right? Like the Homestead Act, we literally gave white people homes en masse as national policy. And they were like, I didn't learn that. They're like, did we? And I'm like, yes, we did that.
You did. And you know what? We did learn it, but it was contextualized as benevolence. And it was not contextualized that at the same time we were doing that, we were denying Black people homes. Absolutely. We were denying former slaves homes. So that's how we end up getting this disingenuous schooling, is that things are not taught within the comprehensive point of view. They're just taught like individual things. Like we're taught, oh, Lois and Clark, Manifest Destiny. They went across America. And it's like, yeah, but you left out the part where they were also leading the way for there to be massacres of Indigenous people in America. Like you left that part.
Absolutely. Or Reconstruction. I didn't even know Reconstruction was a thing until I was an adult.
Don't get me started.
Zero. I had never heard of it. Had you heard about it in high school? I didn't even know Reconstruction was a period of time. I didn't.
DeRay, my nigga, I just learned about Reconstruction 2 months ago on a Delta flight. Don't get me started.
Shut up. Really?
Sir, I have a master's in African American studies. And I did not understand like Reconstruction was a word that I heard applied to. There was this Civil War and now the Civil War was over and they had to reconstruct.
Amanda.
They had that's essentially, it wasn't until I was on this Delta flight and I started watching these videos, a part of this masterclass series called, I think it's called like Black History, Freedom and Love. And they did this in 2020, but they have it like, it's still a masterclass and it's still on Delta. And it has like these like 10 to 15 minute videos about various topics. They did three seasons. They have people delivering these videos like Nicole Hannah Jones, Professor Kimberly Crenshaw, Sherilyn Eiffel, Cornel West. I mean, Angela Davis. Like, I mean, they have like an elite group here, right? So I was just like, let me get some knowledge real quick on this flight. Let me get some knowledge real quick. Cause none of these movies, I've seen all these movies. So I just was like, oh, let me see this video on Reconstruction. What? Like, wow. I sat there in shock and in awe that what I was witnessing was the true, like the holes of my scholarship, like these gaping wide chasms of my scholarship, to the point where then I went and started reading this book by Eric Foner about the Reconstruction.
Who is the scholar? He is the Reconstruction guy. Still alive. So,
I was like, if you gonna do it, like, do it. So, come on. So I started reading The Second Founding by Eric Foner. And you just start to truly understand something. And let me tell you, the key thing that I grasped from this, there's a couple key things, if you don't mind me.
Come on, teach us.
One, it has been the Supreme Court every time that has prevented this country from moving towards the democracy it claims within its constitution to be in pursuance of. Okay. So when I say that, is that the constitution was written at the time for landowning white men, but it was written in a way that had like, it had like looser language that like was
breathing
like
room.
Breathing room. So then when after the Civil War, when they were like, okay, here's the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments, you know, here you all get to be citizens, here you all get to vote, and now here you all, you know, you get to just live in America. There was the language was very loose in those too. And the Supreme Court, the Congress, there were people in Congress who were like, this language is too loose. Like, if we're really going to move towards equity, we need to like protect black people very deliberately in this language. And the Supreme Court was like, nah, we're not going to do that. Y'all can't do that. And the Supreme Court was like, you as Congress, you don't have the power to protect black people. But they gave that same Congress the power to support slave owners with the Dred Scott case and say that slave owners could come to free states and take people and bring them back if they think that they're slaves who are escaped. So when we look at what's going on with our Supreme Court now, we have to understand that this is not necessarily just an American problem. This is a actual like hierarchical problem where we have what's taught as checks and balances, except for them, except right. for them. And they have been the problem every time. And we have been tricked into thinking that it's been the president that's the problem or it's been the Congress that's the problem. And I'm not saying they haven't been problematic, but they have only been able to get away with it by nature of the Supreme Court saying, go ahead. Actually, you know what? Let's just give it to the states. So that was one. Two, I didn't think that I just feel like I thought that there was like the Civil War and then we just went straight into Jim Crow. And that's simply just not the case. Like
literally not the case at all.
It's not the case. Like this, again, those 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendment allowed for rights, but what it did do, it forced black people, though, and this happened again with the Civil Rights and the Voting Rights Act and the Housing Rights Act, it forced black people to hold America accountable. So like they had these laws in place, but because they didn't create something that said that we as America have to hold these laws in place, it said that if you want to challenge this, if someone does this some sideways shit, you're the one who's going to have to bring it to the Supreme Court, which honestly, it's like, OK, so y'all wouldn't let us read and now we got to be lawyers. Like, how that work? But the reason why this is so really important, though, is because they took our rights back. And not enough people understand how easily that was done and how quickly. Like there was 20 years of like, okay, like we out here.
And black people were on the up. On the up.
They're a part of government. We're seeing the Roaring Twenties. Like, you know, okay, we're moving. And then they were like, ah, y'all getting too hype. Let's tone it down. And that's when we see the fugitive slave laws. I mean, sorry, that's when we see, you know, Green Book pop up because you have Jim Crow, which is really simply just apartheid. And we keep calling it Jim Crow, but it really is apartheid. And so like those two things were very just illuminating for me because I feel like those are huge themes that we've seen consistently and that are like rearing their ugly heads. And if we learn from history, then we can prevent it. But if we don't know it, we can't.
Yep. It's interesting. One of the things that stuck with me about Reconstruction was the amount of black wealth. And as you just said, people had it and it was taken away. Like, yes. Money did not protect Black people. No. The rich Black people got screwed like everybody else.
They got lynched.
And I look
too.
At this, yes, and I'm looking at this moment, like, there are Black people who really think that their little millions is protection. And I'm like, we actually have, I didn't know this before, but I'm like, we did this. We've been here before. We were mayors. We ran cities. We ran towns.
Yes.
Snatched away.
Snatched and snatched because the white people became more and more belligerent in their feeling that we didn't deserve it. Are you looking around? Because that's what I'm seeing.
Absolutely. Been here before.
So it's when you start studying, it's like tragic and empowering at the same time. Because I do feel a certain level of empowerment and like, okay, I feel like I'm seeing play. It's, you know what it feels like? It feels like I'm like on a field, not that kind of field, and I'm learning like the playbook. And so now like I have like a lot more ways in which to defeat this opponent because now I have more plays in my coffer like to pull from. But nonetheless, you know, we're constantly working just against ignorance. Like that's what we're really, really up against. I mean, even like you said, like just the fact that so many people feel like, well, if I have money, we're good. They don't been want there. You. You have never been wanted here. You have never been wanted here. They have only been wanted there. You for they have only wanted you for labor.
You know what? You don't need any more work to do. You have a full plate and you are successful and amazing.
Damn it.
But let me tell you that if you wanted to, I think you would be a phenomenal, and Camping Zero would do this with you. Like, not book clubs, but like reading clubs, reading groups. Like, I think there are some essays out there that people just need, you know, like right now, if you were trying to read an essay, where would you go? Like, who would you need people to talk about it with, right? And I think a lot of people don't have a home to do that. Do you know what I mean? And I think that you are a clear storyteller who people trust, who could bring in a set of people who otherwise wouldn't feel like they can pretend. It's one of the issues we have on, you know, we do all this technical work on the police and people just don't feel like they can talk about police unions. They're like, I don't know about unions. I don't know about labor. So we have to create entrances for them. And I think you're just a really good entrance maker. So that is my not even push, little plug.
That's just a side, but I actually want to connect you to somebody who is trying to do this already. And they are the most reputable, actually. And I just don't want to put them out there right now, but they're trying to do this. And I would love to be in partnership with them in doing this. But the reality is you're so right. Like there are a lot of people who do want to know and like be like, we need like salons. You know what I mean? Like remember they used to have salons and they would have these salons so that we could like talk about things and like, you know, ideate and philosophize, you know, cause that's the other thing too. It's like, because of this internet and its immediacy, people expect everybody to show up with thoughts fully formed and, you know, just no level of real like exploration. So I try, you know, to let people know, like you might hear some thoughts from me that are in process, you know, and I think it's important to do that. And we don't have safe spaces to do that, right? Like this week is actually a great example of people who started the week one way.
Absolutely. And you need good facilitators too, who can like hold the space and push and acknowledge and say, okay, man, I see what you're doing. Let me connect that, you know, like, so I think that is real. I want to know too, talking about this week, you know, there are moments where the public conversation is very intense. There's some things where the public conversation is full, but not intense. This is one where like, there seems to be a real line around the Israel-Palestine.
I dated a nigga over this. Okay.
Really?
Yes.
So how do you wade through these moments where people feel very, very strongly on both sides? How has that been for you?
You can feel strongly, but you got to know what you know. And so that's what I've been telling, because, you know, people be calling me, DeRay. You need to be calling me.
Amanda. I mean, I know you're funny and you're a comedian, but...
Baby, they be calling me, girl, what is all of this? You know, because I thought, et cetera, and now I'm understanding X, Y, Z. And I'm like, I know. They're like, can you send me some videos? I'm like, let me send you some links. And I love seeing people have a voraciousness for information, at the very least, so that they don't get canceled for no reason. But I think there, you know, listen, there is a lot of feelings, but one thing that you get afforded if it's not necessarily like directly related to you is the opportunity to have objectivism. Okay. And objectivity at the end of the day is going to be informed by facts. I mean, that's just where it lives. That's the whole point of it. So once you start studying facts, you know, there's really just a very clear understanding that's here because it's not new. This is not new. It looked different, but it's still the same formula. You know, it's like in the Wu-Tang it's like on the Purple Tape when Ghostface is like, I got a whole new way to do clocks. I got a whole new way. So what we're going to do is we're going to do this side blue, but wait for it. On this side, we're going to do cream. So it's going to be like blue and cream, which is oddly fascinating how that actually lines up with this because that was not even intentional. But it's still Clark's. You understand what I'm saying? Like, it's still the thing. It looks different, but it's still the thing. And that's what we're looking at right now. Like, it's still colonialism. It just looks different. And we know that that's the way things go in the world, right? Like, things evolve. Things evolve, but they're still attached to, like, a certain level of principles and behaviors that identify them as such. And when you've studied enough or you've lived enough and you've seen it enough, it doesn't take much to be able to identify it in something else. And so that's really where I've been trying to encourage people to go, is just go to the facts.
Have you, before I ask you this question about Israel Palestine, are you a Wu-Tang scholar?
I mean, I like to think so.
Because you asked Bowman that question. You asked Bowman.
Ask him about the Wu. You know, because the Wu is a very grounding, like, starting point for someone's true hip-hop-ness. I tried to date somebody who told me they were a hip-hop head, and then I asked them. They said they were a hip-hop head, and then they said, but I don't really know about, like, Wu-Tang or anything. And I was just like, get out of my house. Like, what are we even talking about?
So, like, I was like, that was your first, when he answered it right, I was like, thank you, Bowman, because this would be an awkward start to the interview.
You know what, though? Let me tell you, those interviews really showed me that I've, like, really grown as an interviewer. And I've been doing my Small Doses podcast now for, like, 5 years, since 2018. And I was really proud of myself because I really love that you said, like, you didn't know that about Jamal Bowman. You didn't know about his journey to being a representative. And I feel like that was able to come out because a safe space was created, right? And, like, that's hard as an interviewer. Like, sometimes, because especially, yes, like, people like that, like, they're always being interviewed. You know what I'm saying? So right. They're kind of always coming with, like, I'm here to do this. I'm going to say these things. I'm going to do these things. And I was like, yeah, we're not going to do that.
And I don't want to give away, y'all need to watch the documentary, but the moment when you ask him what was the moment and you don't let him off. And I was like, I can see you in this place with your wife and them kids.
So the reason, like, why I like to ask folks that, because I asked Marianne Williamson that and she refused to answer it, like, flat out.
Interesting.
She refused to answer it and she was offended by the question.
Wait, I didn't miss that in the documentary, did I?
No, that's on my podcast.
Okay, I was like, I did watch. Okay.
Like,
I thought I watched it. Okay. Yeah, she refused to answer it.
She wouldn't answer it. I asked her three different times in three different ways. She wouldn't answer it because she was like, I didn't just come up with this just on a random day. And it's like, well, everyone does, though. It arrives, right. Like, it arrives, right? Like, and the example I gave her was that Corey Bush told me that, like, you know, three different times people had approached her about running and she was like, nah. And then the last time she was like, well, okay, let's talk. Right.
Yeah.
And
like, so, you make a decision. That is a fact, Marianne Williamson.
But there's a humanity in that. Right. Mm. And there's a groundedness in, like, where that decision came from and why that decision happened. And we are at a very critical time where people are starting to really realize, like, well, we need to elect people, but there's, like, this morality that people want. And, like, how do we reconcile the two? Because the space itself is immoral. Mm-hmm. And so like, it's a question that I feel like in a very quick way helps to illuminate someone's like just humanity as it relates to their public servitude. Because he wasn't, you know, he was literally washing his kids playing in the water. Like, I mean, you know what I mean? Like, it wasn't
you
like.
You gave it away, not me. Okay. I was trying not to say it.
You're right. My bad.
Watch the documentary,
but,
y'all.
But like the way it unfolds is beautiful. So go to In a Man Do We Trust.
I'm assuming people disagree with your position about Israel and Palestine in this moment. And how have you managed that disagreement?
Oh, I'm just resolute. I'm just like, what are you disagreeing with? Because if you're trying to tell me I'm anti-Semitic, that is completely, wholeheartedly, and 100% untrue, and I will simply just not accept false assertions. Anti-Semitism would mean that I do not believe in the rights of Jewish people to exist in this world. It would believe that I don't see their humanity. It would believe that I don't see their access to joy as something deserving. And none of those things are true. I can believe that Palestinians deserve all those things and that Jewish people deserve all those things. And at the same time, identify the Israeli government impeding upon Palestinians doing those things as a problem. I can do all of those things at the same time, and I can chew gum. And then there's also just like the reality that a lot of people are not connected to their humanity anymore. And you're not going to try and convince me to disconnect from mine. You're not also going to convince me to disconnect from just history and facts. And I already know the world that we're in. We are in a white supremacist world. That is the world we're in. We are in a white supremacist, colonial capitalist world. So that's the context that we're in. And you cannot just take something like obfuscate that. Like the fact is what it is. And so you have to look at everything within that lens. And when you said earlier, like everything is about race, it is.
It is.
This is where we are, you know? Like, I mean, we're so that's my response. I mean, I will tell you that I have been very, 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 very fortunate that I haven't had any of my like professional spaces marred or questioned in my defense of what's going on. I also believe I've built a life where I am expected to speak in these truths. And I stand on that, and I feel very guided by a higher power to do that and very protected. I also feel protected by the people. You know, Ossie Davis said, never stick your neck out deeper than your feet are rooted in the people. He told me that to my face at Purchase College.
Come on. Let him know. I didn't read that. I heard it.
Okay, I was told it.
You gotta come see Pearly Victorious on Broadway, by the way, his play.
Oh, do you mean Pearly that I starred in at Dr. Phillips High School in 1999 that was a legendary production?
My name is Amanda Seals, everybody.
Missy Judson, walk him up. Like, is that what we're talking about? Are we talking about the Pearly Victorious that we actually had to bring back at the end of the year because it was so successful in the beginning of the school year that we had to bring it back? And it is a literal like legacy production. Are we talking about Pearly Victorious that starred Michael James Scott, who is currently playing the role of the genie in Aladdin on Broadway? Are we talking about that Pearly? Maybe we're talking about the Pearly that we then took to the state competition and blew everyone away. Or I actually think you're talking about the Pearly that I will be attending and that at the end of the show we'll be sitting on a panel with Kimberly Crenshaw, who invited me there to have a talk back with Leslie Odom Jr. I think it might be that one.
Look at God. Listen, love it.
It's very serious.
It is a small, good black world.
It is.
There are two questions we ask everybody. The first is, what do you say to people, Amanda, whose hope is challenged in these moments, who are like, I came to your live show, I listened to your podcast, I watched the videos, I shared the videos, I read the book, I went to the talk, and still I'm like, the world ain't changed what I want to do. What do you say to those people?
I've been working on that. I've been working on what to say, because This is a time where I feel like many people are expecting to see the change that they wish to be. But you really just have to be the change that you hope the future sees. And that has to be enough. And the only way for that to be enough is for you to tap into your spirit and soul. And because it requires selflessness. And we have been trained to be selfish, which is why this world is descending into madness, which is why our climate is, you know, changing because of our pressure, because of our greed, right? We have lost sight of the idea of the reality that we're all connected. And I like to think that the ancient people, even if they didn't know that there were other people, they knew that they themselves were connected. And so they had to operate a certain way. And of course, like we study these ancient civilizations and we find things that are abhorrent, et cetera, because humans themselves are just really ridiculous beings. But I think we're at a time where the world is drastically trying to shift, and it's just going to require us to say, I want to feel good that my spirit that's going to live after me feels good about what I did here. And that really is all I can offer people. We are not going to see the change to the extent that we want to see it. I do not believe that. I'm not going to mislead people. You know, when I tell people about voting, I'm like, you're not voting for a person. You're voting for a path. That's what we're voting for.
That's the next t-shirt, y'all. That's the next t-shirt. I now work for Amanda Seals, everybody. I am the unpaid consultant. That is because, the next t-shirt.
Listen, like, people want to vote for Jesus and he's not running for office.
Right.
You know, like, this has never been a moral high ground. So it's weird to apply. It's not weird. I understand why people are applying morality, because they're like, well, I want someone who's going to honor the things that they said they were running on. And in order for me to feel confident about, you know, trusting that they're going to do that, I have to trust that they're a moral person. I get that math. The problem, though, is that there would have to be an entire deconstructing of our political system for us to, you know, be able to fully trust that. So I guess what I really want to just come back to is that we got to lean into love. That sounds corny, but that's really, you got to lean into love, and that is really the best thing that you can do for you and for the future. And if you want to be selfish, then I can also inform you that you probably gonna have to come back to this bitch. So the best thing you can do is set it up for a return.
And then the very last question is, what's a piece of advice that you've gotten over the years that stuck with you?
Well, that Aussie quote is definitely one. This is going to be really, 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 really corny, but corny, be yourself.
Corny is honest. Okay.
Be yourself. And it is so difficult for so many of us to be ourselves. First of all, a lot of us don't even know who we are. So be yourself is really actually a very deep statement. I heard something else recently that I thought was really just like obvious, but impactful. And it was, the love of your life is the love of your life. The love of your life is the love of your life.
Oh, okay. Come on. Preach.
And, you know, I recently got out of a long relationship, and I think that one of the main things that caused our relationship to eventually dissolve was that I really love my life and I really love myself. And that wasn't always the case, but I did the work to get there, and I will not abandon myself. And he wasn't there. And so it's like, we can't exist. We can't coexist in that space. Right. But that phrase, the love of your life is the love of your life, was so impactful to me, because it really said to me, like, it's about you loving your life. And so many of us feel like we're spending our whole life looking for someone to love us.
Yes.
You can love you.
On that note, preach, preacher, preach. Everybody, this is the one and only Amanda Seals. Please go watch In Amanda We Trust.
Go to inamandawetrust.com and get it.
And we consider you a friend of the pod and can't wait to have you back.
Thank you. And I'm not sure when this is going to air, but I'll be doing a screening of In Amanda We Trust in Los Angeles on November 19th at the Hollywood Improv. And when I do the screenings, we give away free stuff. We do political trivia. I do a Q&A. It's always a really good intellectual black ass time.
Well, that's it. Thanks so much for tuning in to Pod Save the People this week. Tell your friends to check it out and make sure you rate it wherever you get your podcast, whether it's Apple Podcasts or somewhere else. And we'll see you next week. Pod Save the People is a production of Crooked Media. It's produced by AJ Moultrie and mixed by Evan Sutton. Executive produced by me, and special thanks to our weekly contributors, Kai Henderson, DR Ballinger, and Miles E. Johnson.